Welcome back to the Athletes for Justice podcast. On this episode, we get a chance to talk with someone who's not necessarily in the athletic world, but man, he talks about justice. His name is John Kleinpeter. He's a white man who lives in Chicago, and he and my stories collided at a liquor store on the west side of Chicago. So listen in. You hear about his conversion experience, as he calls it, and what he's doing as a man in the majority culture to advocate and step up and speak up for change, not only in his community, but also in every community around the world. So make sure to like this podcast, subscribe, share it with your friends. I cannot wait to hear what you all think. Well, the first thing I need to know is that Notre Dame sweater you got going on. What's up with that? Talk to me about that, man.
You went to Texas, right?
So absolutely.
It's been a hard couple of years in that match.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a hard decade, century for y'all. I mean, I was doing some college football analysis over the last year, and I mean, Notre Dame in big games, y'all have struggled. I thought Oklahoma used to struggle in big games, and I looked at Notre Dame's big game schedule. It is piss poor, would be an understatement.
Sam, I don't know why you'd start such an amicable conversation by throwing such salt on my wound. And this is what keeps me up at night, is the big game. We just know, my family knows that when the big game's on, we're going to be disappointed. So,
what's your history? What's your history with Notre Dame?
That's where I got my MBA.
Nice.
Yeah. Grew up in Indiana, so grew up a Notre Dame fan. IU basketball fan and Notre Dame football fan. So had the chance to go there and loved it and had an amazing experience. So, yeah.
Did you go there partly because of you were a fan, or was it like, hey, this is the best program? Like, what was there any, cause I wonder if people choose schools. Like, is it like, hey, like I really want to watch their basketball team or their football team?
Yeah. That's a great question. I was looking at a number of the different Chicago programs, and actually, I loved like the ethical foundation that everything went through this filter of doing good in business and doing right as best you can. So not that we get that right, especially not in big games at the University of Notre Dame. But that really resonated with me. And then it was just icing on top to go to the place that I watched growing up every Saturday. So
that's awesome. Well, you and I have a mutual friend in Steve Carter. And so Steve reached out, yes, and told me a little bit of your background, but man, I'd love for you to kind of share with everyone listening, like tell some of your background and then we'll hop into some conversation.
Yeah. So I grew up in Indiana, Fort Wayne, Indiana, nothing too exciting. Couldn't wait to get out of Fort Wayne. So at 18, moved up here, went to Trinity up in Deerfield for a couple of years. So I was excited to get to Chicago, and always loved coming up here as a kid, and ended up going into ministry. So I was a pastor for 22 years, did that from 20 until I was 20 years old till 2016 when I left that. But yeah, so a lot of my experience is around ministry and pastoral leadership and leading a congregation. And that's how I got started. And then really pivoted in 2016 after getting my MBA and deciding that my next run was going to be a little different focused. My faith is still deeply important to me. It governs and guides me, but it wasn't how I was going to live occupationally in the next career. So that kind of got me to here, to where I am now. Yeah.
And where are you now, right? What, so yeah, you talk about that pivot, where are you now and what does life look like since 2016?
Yeah, so I guess a little more background. I had kind of a conversion experience when I was in high school, specific to race and inequality. So I was at a friend's house. I was 16, and we watched "Do the Right Thing" by Spike Lee. And there's a scene in there where Radio Raheem, one of the main characters, is strangled to death by a police officer. And I, again, Fort Wayne, Indiana, multiculturalism was going to the Chinese restaurant that moved in down the street, right? Like I had no idea. So I watched that and I got home and I just wept. Like I couldn't process, because policing to me was never something you were scared of. I had no concept of racial inequality. and saw that and just knew I needed to do something. Didn't know what. So the next day, I joined the African-American club at my high school and started a 2-year journey with these incredible peers who let me learn from them about their experience as Black Americans. And that was unbelievably transformative for me to see the world I did not know existed. And again, the graciousness of them. I mean, I asked every stupid white boy question imaginable, right? I still have it.
Can I hear some of the questions?
Oh, goodness.
Well, I mean, because I think, okay, what did your school look like as far as demographics?
Yeah,
and then also that African-American club, like what was that experience like? Like take me to the first day you walk in to the African-American club and it's like, hey guys, I'm John. Like, hey, what was that like?
So my school was probably 15 to 20% non-white. So very white population, but there was this like energetic, beautiful African-American club. And a couple of things I remember going in. One, I had a few friends who were already involved who kind of validated me being there and saying, this is okay. Cause I told, I'm heartbroken. I don't know what to do. Like, I think this is some of the challenge when you're of majority culture and white in America, when you have an awakening, you feel dumb that you haven't known. You feel like, do I even step in? Cause I'm probably going to mess this up and say stupid things. So it was scary. And the kindness of, I mean, I'm still in touch with some of these friends, like Jantina, who just let me be unknowledgeable, and Angela and Joey, and they just amazing peers who let me walk in and be like, I don't know anything about your experience and I want to. And so one other thing that was really interesting to me is each club had a faculty advisor, and the faculty advisor for the African American club was a white social studies teacher who was also one of the football coaches. And what I learned from him is he empowered the voice of the minority. He did not grab the reins of this thing. He let it be uncomfortable. He let it be run by students. And that was a big lesson for me for what it looks like to set aside the unearned privilege of whiteness in a room like that and let become a learner and an empowerer and not needing to be the center of the narrative. So for 2 years, I was in that club and we would talk about the challenges because our school, this was, you know, mid 90s, early 90s, because I graduated in 93. So there was not the same awareness we have today, even of racial issues in America. So they were telling the story in that moment. We were trying to advocate and learn together. And for me, it was very little talking and a whole lot of listening, you know, which is hard for a white male.
Right. Right. So how did that experience shape where you are now?
So that transformation started a belief in the need for white people, specifically white males, to engage in conversations and action around race and inequality. Like, it can't just fall on the Black and brown community to say this is a problem and it needs to change, right? That's not fair. And it requires laying down of unearned privilege for equality to even happen. And so that began a journey for me that led to, even in the work I did as a pastor, I was always focused on that. And, you know, in our odd connection. So when I was a pastor in Chicago at a church called Willow Chicago, it was the downtown church of Willow Creek Community Church. And we had a very diverse congregation. We were really trying to be representative of the city. I was leading that church as a white male, realizing that I had a lot to learn still. And this was 2012. Chicago was just exploding with violence, not that unlike even now. And the city, I think it was the Tribune, would rank the neighborhoods that were the most violent. And Austin was consistently each quarter at the top of that list, the Austin neighborhood on the west side. And I did, again, just like in high school, I didn't know what to do. And so I couldn't sit by. And so I decided to spend each Saturday night for about 2 to 3 hours between 8 and midnight, somewhere in there, walking the Austin neighborhood, just trying to engage people for the hope that a conversation might help someone feel seen. I look back at it now.
Can I stop you for a second, John?
Yeah.
So people who don't know Austin, Austin is a predominantly minority neighborhood, Black and Hispanic. You are a 40-something, maybe now 50-something-year-old white guy walking through those neighborhoods on Saturday nights. What did you feel? Like, take us.
So there. I had a friend, my friend David. He had a really interesting background for this too. He served 3 tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, specifically in the counterinsurgency work, where they wouldn't lead with force, they would lead with relationship. So they would build relationships in villages where they were not wanted. And so he was a really interesting person to walk with. And he was in education reform. He was working in some of the Black and brown communities in Chicago around charter schooling and trying to create equalized opportunity. So we would walk. And at first, honestly, I was just scared. And I was scared because I didn't know what I was doing.
What were you scared of?
I was scared of doing more damage by Austin doesn't need more white people to come into it and save it, right? So I was scared my presence might be taken wrong. I was scared that, well, honestly, if I'm totally, like, again, candid with my own racial brokenness, I was scared my car would get broken into. Like, I was scared about pragmatic things. I wasn't really scared for my safety. That was never, because honestly, in those neighborhoods in Chicago, and you know how this works, as a white man, I'm not the one in danger in those neighborhoods. So that wasn't something that I had a lot of fear about, but I was scared, one, that it wouldn't make a difference, which honestly, if candidly, I don't know if it did, I hope, but I had a lot of fear. But to be honest, after 3 or 4 weeks of it, it was more excitement. The conversations we started to have, the beauty of the people of the Austin neighborhood, that was overwhelming to me. I just fell in love with the people of the Austin neighborhood. It's so my feelings quickly shifted. And then, as with a lot of transformation in a white person, when they're becoming more aware, you start to see what are these systems of brokenness within a neighborhood that create that neighborhood and what it is. And that became David and I's journey for the year, discussing that, engaging in that, talking, praying over it. That was part of our journey.
What did you find? You said that journey, that year, that journey, what did you find?
Yeah. I thought at first that there was some, because again, I was a very spiritual person. I was a pastor. And I thought, if I come into this neighborhood, what if, can we just pray with people? And maybe someone who's prayed with won't do self-harm later in that night. And I realized there's a church on just about every block in Austin. So I think I started to evolve to think this isn't a spiritual solution. And we would like walk Lake Street, and Lake Street is industrial building after industrial building that's vacant and unused. And we passed schools, and we would see there were no grocery stores. And so it started to form in me a different view of what's actually needed in neighborhoods like this in Chicago and probably everywhere. Access to healthy food, right? That's the one you're stepping into, even in Austin. Access to safe community policing. The policing I saw in Austin was really different than the policing I saw in Lakeview.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean by that? And so I'm going to stop for a quick second. I don't know if it's on my end or yours. I feel like there's like some background stuff going.
Might be because I'm at my manufacturing company. Oh. And there's behind that door, they're literally making metal parts right now. So I apologize.
No, it's all good. It's all good. No,
that's
not a
problem. Later part of the story we can get into. But yes, you might hear metal being cut.
Awesome. Okay. Well, I'm excited to hear that part of the story as well. But before we get there, continue.
So the policing side, what is the difference, you asked? I'd never in my neighborhood seen a militaristic response of policing. I'd never seen helicopters swooping down around homes. I had not seen raids happening on homes. I had not, I had seen police officers out and engaging with people. In Austin, I saw police officers only in their cars, driving really fast through alleys and down streets. There was one instance we had where we were walking and two police officers pulled up in their car, and they were Caucasian police officers, and they rolled down their window and they asked sarcastically, "Do you know what neighborhood you're in?" Yeah, we're here every Saturday night. Why on earth would you be here every Saturday night? Like, that spirit was just heartbreaking.
What now, was I will response say, when they asked you,
yeah, so I said, "We walk this neighborhood every Saturday and we're trying to engage with the community here and meet any needs we can." And they're like, "Okay." And they drove off. Yeah. And at the same time, we met incredible police officers who walked the neighborhood, who knew the neighbors, and you could tell, right? I'm not trying to paint with a wide brush, but the what safety looked like in Austin was different than what it looked like in Lakeview, specifically to policing. The other thing, a couple of things that I saw that were missing, as I mentioned on Lake Street, there may be a church on every corner, but there wasn't a job on every corner, right? Like access to a living wage employment, access to generational opportunity for wealth creation. Like those were non-existent, and there was not the economic development in that neighborhood that would help it be healthy and thriving. If you can't have access to healthy food, you can't thrive. If you can't have access to income, you can't thrive. Those things were missing. And then, as I mentioned, schools, and my friend David was deeply involved in the education reform work in the city. Access to an equalized education that opens doors and unleashes kids wasn't present either. So we started to see, okay, we thought we were coming here to pray. And I think, you know, again, this is so much of my journey with whether it was high school and African American Club or this, as a white person stepping into a world that I do not know, I think the solution is one thing. The solution is very different, and it is not me focused. It's opportunity focused. And that was some of what we evolved in our engagement in Austin over that year. Mm. But can I tell the you part of the story?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So I'm watching the news, and there's a few minute segment on the grocery that you guys are out there in front of it. They're taking pictures, cutting tape. So David and I, our hub for every Saturday night for that year was that liquor store that really? You guys turned into a grocery store. That's where we would, in the cold of winter, because we did this in winter in Chicago. So February nights, we'd pull up my car there. We had loaded the back full of hot cocoa and coffee. And we would just give it out of the trunk. It's funny. Everyone thought we were cops, right? When we'd walk
undercover,
right? So you'd hear the whistles when we're walking down the alley. You'd hear 5-0, and like we were just walking. It was absolutely hilarious. But in front of that liquor store, the guys who are out there selling squares, they would tell everyone these guys are okay. They're not
real
cops.
Real quick, I got to stop you. Because some people might hear selling squares and it's like, is that like the swipe machine? Like they're selling like a little square. What? Yeah.
So like cigarettes, they're selling individual cigarettes out in front.
So not the swipe, not like the square, like pay, no. Auto pay. Okay, cool.
Just no, they're not selling iPhone auto pay. That's not what they were selling out there. So they would give us the credibility for people to engage. And we could talk about needs. We could hand out something warm in the winter to drink. We could hand out something. We had, you know, big coolers of ice water in the summer. And so the guys selling squares in front of the liquor store that's now a grocery were the guys who welcomed us and let us have credibility. And we would, and the number of times we prayed in front of that liquor store, because we know, you know what, there's violence around there too, right? Because liquid courage and all the mistakes that can be made with it. So when I saw that story, I just texted Steve and I'm like, the next time we hang out, I have got a story for you. And so I'm so glad he connected us because it's so redemptive to see that specific location be turned into something that's addressing one of the five key issues that's true of the Austin neighborhood, that lack of access to healthy, nutritious food for people.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because, you know, Steve had reached out and mentioned the story, a little bit of the story. I didn't know all the details, the technology selling squares. I don't know about that piece. But he was just saying how it's like, yeah, I know a guy who's been, he would walk that block every week for years. And then all of a sudden, and I even think about the times that I've been in that neighborhood before Austin Harvest, right? The food mart before that was built. And just seeing some of the, you talk about the activity, right? There's a lot of activity. And then yeah. Even, I remember when it was torn down and the pop-up mart was built up. Even some of the police officers said before they wouldn't even go down that block. They wouldn't even go down that block because of all the activity, whether that's gang activity, violence, drugs. They wouldn't even go down that block, which that even baffles my mind at times. This is a different conversation for the podcast, but just the idea of, like you talked about, that difference in policing in certain areas. That's a real thing. Yeah. Like, that's a real thing. Cause I'm thinking, okay, we talk about shootings and killings and murders, but I'm like, aren't the police supposed to help prevent that? But then you hear of people who spend time in those neighborhoods, the relationship with the police is not amicable. And some of my, you know, so I know that's not for every police officer, but you know, in that Absolutely. Neighborhood specifically, but yeah. But so then hearing this, go ahead.
I was going to say, even as you talk about that difference in policing, they're not getting out of their cars because they're scared. Right. Like I felt we were scared early on. I think that evolved for us and we felt apart when we were there. You never got that sense from the police officers. Except there were some, again, who they saw their role differently and they were engaged with people. And with that engagement, this is true in every area of life, right? As you engage the other, the walls fall down that make you scared and resistant to that person. The same was true for us as we engaged. The same was true for the police we saw who engaged in a healthy way in that neighborhood. It's not surprising that there was fear to go down that street because that was a wild street in 2012, 2013. Mm-hmm. Certainly when we were out there with Hot Cocoa and Squares. I wasn't selling squares. I just want to be really clear.
You were buying the squares. You were processing the payments on a Square app. Right. I get it. That's right. No one else is going to know. Right.
But Sam, John, we had to pay for the Hot Cocoa somehow.
Exactly. Yeah. Business. I do need to know though. So, and our listeners need to know, so what you talked about this transition, and I feel like I'm like the cliffhanger, like what do you do now? Like, yeah. What is it that, what do you do now?
So in 2013, I went back to school while I was still a pastor and got my MBA and graduated in 2015. And then in 2016, I left full-time ministry and started a consulting firm called Better Good Group. And focusing on for-profits, not-for-profits, and churches who are trying to make the world better. So one of my first clients for the first 2 years of the company was Starbucks, and was working with them. They have they partnered with the Schultz Foundation for a nationwide effort to create living wage jobs and jobs that tie to education opportunity and healthcare for at-risk youth. So we would put on these giant job fairs where we'd have 1,500 jobs in a day in Atlanta, being given away at the conference center there. And there'd be 50 companies. Starbucks would quarterback it. We'd have Chick-fil-A and you'd have, 50 companies, Marriott, and everyone would bring, and they'd interview kids right there. So this was transformative for me, where I would help on the front end, rally all their volunteer teams. We'd get faith community involved, civil community involved. Kids would walk in. There'd be 2,000 kids who'd walk into one of these events. They walk in with their resume. Some of them, I'd look at them because I was at the front and I'd be like, okay, we got a few spelling mistakes. We have a resume station. I'm going to walk you over there. We're going to clean this up before you go to your interview. They would walk around the room, pick which of the companies they wanted to interview with. They would have an interview that day. And then many times they would get a job offer that day to start working.
Wow.
And these are, again, Starbucks has a tuition reimbursement program with the University of Arizona. And then they have healthcare and things like that. So the amazing part was I saw a kid come in and he was so scared. And this was often the case. They were just overwhelmed. Walked through his resume. It was actually solid as it was. So he comes and finds me about 3 hours later and he has a job offer from Starbucks. Wow. And he's going to take it. He has a job now. Well, Howard Schultz happened to be standing 5 feet away from us at this point. And I'm like, you've got to go over and meet the founder and CEO of Starbucks. So I connect them and Howard just wraps his arm around the kid. And he's like, welcome to the team. So glad. And like, you see this and this kid goes from scared and timid to hopeful. And something happened to me when I saw that. And so I decided to keep doing the consulting side, but focus more of my energy. And I purchased acquired a manufacturing company near O'Hare Airport with the purpose of building the middle class through living wage jobs and manufacturing. So our purpose is to train and empower people to have a living wage job that can create that generational opportunity that can transform lives. And so we're 2 years old. I bought a fixer-upper of a company that's literally blood, sweat, and tears over the last 2 years to get it. We actually we're hiring our first new role right now, for entry level. So far, our few applicants, because it just opened up this week. One guy I know who is a homeless guy, a part of our homeless ministry. Another kid is an 18-year-old recent graduate from high school, African-American kid who wants to learn a trade. So like these are the kind of job opportunities we're trying to create. And full circle to Austin. So two of my vendors are in the Austin neighborhood. So I end up there every few weeks. And it's still, I always take an extra 10 minutes and just drive a little and just pray and take it all in and see. And I always drive down Lake Street because the vision for me is when we can expand as a company to more sites, the first one is on Lake Street in the Austin neighborhood to create living wage job opportunities. A skilled trade where someone can have a career. Maybe college isn't the right thing for them, as it's not for a lot of kids who end up in college. Ended up with a ton of school debt. So we're trying to, again, build that middle class, but would love to be on the solution side of neighborhoods like Austin on the economic development piece to create jobs. So that's still very... the transformation of my year in that neighborhood is still very much with me and defining some of my... even business goals in the coming years.
What do you hope to see? What change in 1 year, in 10 years, in 20 years? You said you left your previous role, you bought up this fixer-upper, and now you started a company in order to see change. What is the change that you hope to see?
Yeah. Well, I think hope. Hope is what I saw in those kids' eyes when they got a job through the Starbucks work. So I think economic opportunity builds hope. A lot of things build hope. Like I'm a person of deep faith. I believe faith builds hope. I think access to food builds hope. I think a job builds hope. I think also pragmatically, when you have to be at a job at 6 a.m, you're not doing stupid stuff at 2 a.m, right? Like, it was true for me. All my jobs in high school and college were industrial jobs, and it made for a lot less tomfoolery because I had to be somewhere early. So I think that there's opportunity for young adults to get some focus and some cause in their life. But ultimately, it's economic development opportunity. That's the purpose. That's the hope. So in a year, I want us to have, 6 to 12 new jobs in this facility. In Franklin Park. In 3 years, I want to have on Lake Street, a facility with CNC machines where people are learning a skilled trade, where they, it's not just a job for a person, it's a generational opportunity. That's what I think is key. And honestly, what most of our systems of inequality have robbed the Black and Brown community of, that generational opportunity. If white folks are out there and they haven't read Family Properties yet, buy the book and read it because it outlines the economic depravity that and wrong that was done in the Black community in Chicago and housing in the 30s through the 50s that we still see, right? It's estimated that $1 million a day was fleeced from the Black community during a 40-year era based on immoral business loan practices for home purchase. If think of the nice neighborhoods in Chicago, right? The good ones. If you took $1 million a day in revenue and economic opportunity out of those neighborhoods, what would they look like in 40 years? My guess is they'd look a lot like the challenges in Austin, except they'd be white neighborhoods, right? So creating that generational opportunity that's no longer based on skin color, that needs to happen. And that's what I'm personally trying to give myself to.
If I could take you back for a second, and thank you so much for what you've shared. Before that moment in high school.
Yeah.
Before that time, you said, okay, I got to join this African-American club so I can learn and empathize. Was there something before that you could say may have even been brewing before you even knew it was brewing? And then obviously what you did about it.
Yeah. A couple of things I would say. One, I'll just be totally candid. I can only speak for white people, but I believe we all have racism in us. I've given most of my life to learning about racial inequality, and I have racism in me. I don't think it ever just goes away. And so that I say that as a caveat to share. So I used to think that it was funny to talk in accents, ethnic-based accents, before I had this transformational experience. So I remember I pulled up to a restaurant and I made my order in an Indian accent. I was a kid, it was stupid, inappropriate. I pull up to the window and it's an Indian person who's serving me my food. Mm. I don't know that I've ever been so embarrassed in my life, even since. Because they just looked at me. And I thought, why would that be funny to me? I used to think gay jokes were funny. Like, why would that be funny? Why would the dehumanization of another person be funny to me? And so that, I think, was a precursor to that transformation, was shame and embarrassment at my racism that was in me and honestly is still in me, and that I have to work every day to be less of. Even in all that work and reading and engagement, it's still just there. And I think racism would take a giant leap forward if more white folk would just say, yeah, it's in me. Yeah, when a white person cuts me off in traffic, my response inside is different than when someone else does. Like, we have these assumptions, and I wish we would just say them and normalize it and then start to bring healing to them. Because I promise you, after that day, I never thought it was funny to talk in an accent again. Because that was transformative.
If I can ask one more.
Yeah.
I think everyone has a moment like that where you feel that shame or maybe regret or maybe fear. And I don't think everyone knows exactly what to do with it. I think a lot of people feel that sense of shame and then they sit in it. Or they feel that sense of shame and then they almost like devolve into nothingness and just hide in a corner in certain ways. But I don't believe that's the answer. I think there's a way to turn that shame into something greater, turn your pain into something more powerful. If you could speak to, say, a white person listening who's felt that shame. What would you say?
Yeah, I actually love how you're phrasing that, because I don't feel called to tell Black and Brown communities what they should work on. That is not my place. I do feel a sense of calling to speak truth to the white majority culture community, specifically in America, because that's where it's a majority culture. And I think take the shame and turn it into learning. There's never been easier access to resources to understand the racialized truth of our nation, both history and present. It's ubiquitous, the opportunity for learning and growth. So I often share resource lists with white friends who just need to dive in and learn. And the answer can't be go to your one black friend and ask them for the download on racism. I think that's really selfish and unfair. I think growing in understanding of one's racial brokenness as a white person requires sacrifice. You have to give something. You have to give up some power. You have to give up time. You have to sacrifice, or it will not be lasting. And I think part of that sacrifice is to dive in, to choose to watch less shows and read more books that are really uncomfortable. Because it, like me, it wasn't malicious that I entered into this way of thinking. It was just the privilege of never having to think about race, right? That's such a white person problem, to never have to think about race. That was my childhood and upbringing. So take that shame, focus it on learning and growth and development, and then own it. Own your racism. Own that there is a part of you that sees people differently. Honestly, there's such freedom in that. Because if you respond to that shame with denial or self-defense, I actually think it drives those racialized foundations even deeper and creates a pretty dark place for people. So acknowledge it, find some white friends who you can say, yep, this is broken to me. Can we learn together? Don't put all the weight on the black and brown community to help you come to understanding. Do that work yourself. And when you've done that work and learned and are willing to acknowledge that brokenness, I think a lot could happen, because that's the last part. Like for me, it turns into action, right? So the hope of a manufacturing facility in Austin on Lake Street is not the great white hope coming in to save the black people in Austin. If that doesn't become employee owned at some point to create generational wealth, then I have failed. Then it's just been me creating more wealth for my family by employing people. Now, I'm not trying to say it would be inherently wrong to build business that employs people. What I'm saying is I know the history and the story and the inequality that's happened in our city. For me, it would be unethical to just build something that creates generational wealth for my people, right? And not also for the people who are working there. So that's the action for me. Each white person needs to figure out their action. But I know that learning is always followed by action, or it's just wasted.
Wow. John, thank you so much.
Thank you. My goodness. It's such a honor to meet you here. Candidly, my son is flipping out today. He's 14, about to enter his first tackle season, wants to be a linebacker, and is a huge Bears fan. So you're giving me enormous street cred at home for inviting me. He was born on Super Bowl Sunday in 2007 when the Bears lost to the Colts.
Yes. Like
he is through and through. So you've honestly, this is a service to me. He will listen to me a little better tonight when I say do your chores.
Yes, yes. So shoot, I got to meet him one day so I can give him some tips. Is he playing inside linebacker or outside linebacker?
He's not sure yet. This is his first tackle season. He's an eighth grader, and so he's just stepping into tackle, so he's not sure yet.
Tell him to move to outside. See. That's where all the playmakers play, on the outside. The defensive leaders play inside linebacker. So you know his quality is best. But yeah, I'd love to be able to connect and maybe give him some tips.
That's awesome. He would lose his mind.
Awesome. Well, John, thank you so much for joining the podcast today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Awesome. Wow. Thank you so much to John Kleinpeter for sharing with us an example of how we should respond, specifically white people. As he said, speaking of white people, here are some things we can do. I love how he used what he had. He said, I want to do some consulting. I want to start a company. So as we're thinking of what we can do, ways we can make change, just find ways to channel that energy, to channel that anger, frustration, instead of hiding it, like John talked about, let's show it to the world. Let's bring our true selves. John mentioned a book. You'll see it at the bottom in the link. Also, if you want to learn more, check out my book, Let the World See You, How to Be Real in a World Full of Fakes. Thank you all for listening and checking out the Athletes for Justice podcast. Make sure to subscribe to this podcast and share it with your friends. I'm grateful for you all.